Hello, everybody. I'm Salil Tripathi from the Institute for Human Rights and Business, talking today via Skype with Jessica Evans, who's a senior advocate and researcher on international finance institutions based in Washington. She works with Human Rights Watch, and Human Rights Watch published a recent report which basically looked at the World Bank and its interface with communities that might be opposing to projects that are financed by the World Bank, and what happens to human rights defenders who might be opposing the project, but still they have absolutely the rights to protest, rights to participate politically. And what sort of responsibilities does the bank have in this regard? So thank you very much for the report, Jessica. My first question is that your report has several cases of repression or reprisal against those who protest World Bank projects. What prompted you to take up this issue, and did you see a rising trend? Was that the reason why you went for it?
We have been seeing throughout the world a decreasing space for civil society, or put another way, several governments embarking on these broad campaigns to shut down space for independent groups, including through the passage of restrictive NGO laws and targeting human rights defenders, environmental activists, and journalists. So within this broader climate, we did expect that there would be an increasing challenge for community members and for activists to be able to speak freely, both when they have a concern about a project which is financed by the World Bank, the IFC, or another donor, but also even to be able to freely participate and give their views in the consultations that governments are meant to host, and companies together with the IFC are meant to host ahead of approval of these projects. So we focused on this report so as we could get a better understanding both of the degree of reprisals that are taking place around the world linked to World Bank group finance projects, but also so as we could really look to see what the World Bank is doing, both to prevent these reprisals and then, when things do go wrong, to see how they do respond.
Right. And can you describe some of the patterns of harassment that you've seen? I noticed a case where, you know, there's gender-based attacks, if not violence, at least verbal and insulting attacks on women. That is one. And there's another case that you mentioned about someone being taken away and potentially tortured, an interpreter.
That's right. So what we found were that governments and companies have threatened, intimidated, and misused criminal laws against community members who have criticized projects financed by the World Bank and by its private sector lending arm, the International Finance Corporation. In addition, we found that security forces have cracked down on protesters through force and again through trumped-up charges. As you mentioned, in one case in northern India, we did see that there was both a gender and a caste-based element to the threats, intimidation, and the harassment. So a number of women who were protesting a project, a hydroelectric power project, said that employees of the company ridiculed them and their fellow protesters, calling them prostitutes and viciously insulting them, referencing their caste. Mm-hmm. In Cambodia, we did also find that the majority of the activists, particularly in the Bonk, in one particular case which involves forced evictions from Bangkok Lake area of Phnom Penh. The majority of the activists are women, and some of the threats and intimidation that they have faced have also had this gendered component. In a number of countries, we have seen this use of trumped-up charges or of charges which are would usually be just there would be a warning or maybe a misdemeanor rather than mm-hmm. an actual criminal charge being brought. Mm-hmm. Being brought against protesters and against outspoken community members or activists. In both cases where it's the World Bank financing the project and where it's the IFC financing the project, we found that it can be either the government or a company that is involved. It actually doesn't matter whether the financing is going to the government or to the company. In some of the IFC cases, we found that it was the government actors that were themselves threatening and harassing community members. And then in some of the cases where it was the World Bank financing the government, we found that it was contractors who were hired by the government that were actually behind some of the threats and harassment. So that was one really interesting finding in the report, that the motivation or the the institution that is behind the reprisals can really vary from case to case, irrespective of the financing mechanism that's used.
Right. Now, the World Bank could reply, or its supporters could reply, that the World Bank has inspection panels and the International Finance Corporation has performance safeguards. Are you suggesting they're not effective?
I'm not suggesting that they're not effective. I'm suggesting that they're very much not enough.
Right.
And that they don't address the problem of reprisals or create that safe environment that is really needed for community members to be able to participate in the development of projects, and then to hold both the bank, governments and corporations to account when they see things going wrong. So the performance standards for the IFC are very important, and the safeguards are similarly important for the World Bank. And the accountability mechanisms at both of the institutions, the inspection panel and the compliance advisor ombudsman, play a really important role. But those standards and those mechanisms alone are not enough to prevent reprisals. What we really need to see is the World Bank management making this a key priority for them, so as then they're raising these issues in their day-to-day conversations with governments, making it clear to governments that it is a priority for them to have a secure environment within which people can criticize the World Bank or the government in order to achieve better development. So we see this as falling very squarely within the World Bank's mandate, and very much linked to some of the language that we're hearing from the bank about the importance of participation and accountability. President Jim Kim has spoken quite a lot about the importance of identifying mistakes that the bank makes and rectifying those mistakes. But the bank, it can only really find out about those mistakes if people speak up.
Right.
And the bank has an obligation to support those people that
and listen to them. And the climate should be without fear. That goes without saying. Absolutely.
Exactly.
So here's the dilemma for the World Bank, because what we're talking about is the leverage that the bank has. Because in your report, you do outline several instances where the World Bank has or can or could have intervened in a better way. But however, the primary perpetrator of the abuse is often a private security force or a state security force or a state or a private company or its agents. What sort of leverage does the World Bank have?
We see the World Bank as having quite significant leverage because, as I was saying, we see this as falling squarely within their development mandate. And when the World Bank is creating or supporting a conversation with governments about the importance of criticism for development effectiveness, not so much using the human rights language that we're more used to, but really grounding it in the importance of it for economic growth and for achieving the Millennium Development Goals or the Sustainable Development Goals, as they're soon to be, then governments will pay attention. At the same time, corporations will pay attention when it's raised by the IFC, which is seen as a leading financier in development support. So what we believe that if the particularly the World Bank president and the group's governing board set a tone for the organization that sends a clear message to all staff that they're expected to work diligently to prevent and respond to threats, intimidation, and all other reprisals linked to the group's activities, then it will create a space both for the dialogue with governments, but also for improved mechanisms at the project level.
Yeah.
So we see this as being both necessary. We see it as necessary for the World Bank to address this both at the country level and at the project level. At the country level, emphasizing the kind of dialogue that I've mentioned,
mm-hmm.
and in the bank's country strategies, which it negotiates with governments, articulating the kinds of challenges that exist to having freedom of expression, assembly, and association, including those repressive NGO laws and crackdowns on activists and journalists.
Yeah, which unfortunately is only getting worse, as we all know. If the World Bank were to strengthen the procedures and practices, is it not inevitable that the borrowing countries will increasingly turn in future to the Asia-Africa Investment Bank on one hand, the Infrastructure Investment Bank that is being proposed, or the BRICS Bank, which Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa are developing? And would that not in a way create greater dangers for the kind of risks that we are talking about?
That's something that I hear from time to time from employees at the World Bank. And actually, I think that threat is not as real as it is sometimes mm-hmm. put to us. There is a massive demand around the world for infrastructure in investment. And the AIIB and the BRICS Development Bank, the new development bank,
mm-hmm.
will both have an important role to play. And I hope that they, like the World Bank, will put in place safeguards to ensure respect for human rights in their own financing. We're a long way from that with the Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank and with the New Development Bank, but I'm still hopeful that that's the path that they will take. When we hear from the World Bank that if they raise these kinds of issues and if they have standards which ensure respect for human rights, that recipient governments or companies will go elsewhere, then I think that means that development is not their primary focus.
Right.
We know that respect for human rights is key for development. We know that participation is key for development. So if the World Bank Group is not willing to put itself behind this because it fears that then it may go out of business, I think that goes to show that development is not its primary focus. Its primary focus is to stay in business at all costs.
Right.
What we really don't want to see here is a race to the bottom
yes.
on standards because there is a fear of increased competition. What we would like to see the World Bank do is really stand up firmly and say, we have been the development leader, we have put in place important safeguards because we recognize the kind of harm that bad development projects can cause, and we're going to remain the leader by integrating human rights into all of our policies, but very much within this area by saying participation is key and we're going to prioritize it.
Mm-hmm.
Back after the Arab Spring, President Zalek, then the president of the World Bank, came out publicly and said, one of the things that I think the World Bank needs to learn from the Arab Spring is that we can't only rely on what governments are saying. We need to know what is the feeling of the people and what the people really want as far as development goes, and what the people are trying to tell us when they're trying to hold their governments and us to account. And the World Bank really needs to learn that lesson that President Zalek highlighted back several years ago. And I think a key element of that is preventing and responding to reprisals.
That's a very good homework task you've given to the bank staff, and also it's something that both people at AIIB and BRICS should note very carefully. Thanks very much, Jessica, and all the best with your work. And we hope to stay in touch.
Thank you so much, Salil.
Yeah, thank you.